Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We're your hosts this week. I'm Erin.
And I'm Vanessa.
In this edition,
Just to be able to claim those airwaves and to proudly identify as we are Puyallup is huge. And once we had the radio station with that, I noticed a lot of people were really proud of Puyallup FM.
The ecological importance of these species is just second to none. The role they play is can't be replaced. They're a species we absolutely can't afford to lose.
Especially with something that is such a lived experience, you could not understand it because you haven't felt it.
But first, here are the headlines.
Across Canada, people have been demonstrating against the ongoing aerial bombardment of the Gaza Strip by the Israeli army. Hundreds of people took to the streets in Montreal and also marched in Vancouver.
In Hamilton, Ontario, the Hamilton Line 9 organizers are calling for a day of action against the Enbridge pipeline, known as Line 9. Line 9 is to run through the community and carry diluted bitumen, the material extracted from the tar sands in Alberta. If built, the pipeline will run from Sarnia, Ontario, through Hamilton, into Quebec and Montreal, and then south into the United States.
Now we go to headlines from Catherine Fisher on a change to bus routes in British Columbia.
The Passenger Transportation Board of BC will announce by the end of January whether Greyhound Lines Canada will be allowed to cut services to 15 of its 19 routes in British Columbia. If permitted to do so, rural routes in the southern interior, northern BC, and Vancouver Island regions will all be heavily affected. Board Director Jan Brook says the board has to weigh two factors, quote, basically, the board considers what level of service will meet public need. Another thing the board will look at is the financial health of the applicant. Greyhound stated in its application that it lost $14 million on its BC routes last year, mostly because of higher fuel costs and reduced ridership. Greyhound BC Passenger Service Manager Grant Odson said, quote, I do feel for the smaller communities to some extent and know they will feel cut off, but we're seeing a shift in demographic, among a number of other things. Unfortunately, we need to make a business case. Should all of the changes requested be approved, Greyhound plans to eliminate approximately 2.2 million operating miles in BC and generate yearly operating savings of approximately $6.75 million. If it cannot reach that target, Greyhound says it is prepared to stop service altogether in BC. Many of the rural communities currently serviced by Greyhound have no other bus or train service and in many cases, no airport access either. The board has received approximately 160 comments from businesses, civic leaders, and passengers on Greyhound's proposal, commenting on the proposal closed on October 24th.
And now for a labor headline out of British Columbia. Workers at Coast Hotels and Resorts, a Western hotel chain located in Victoria, Nanaimo, Kelowna, and Prince George, voted by a margin of 92% in favor of a new contract. The contract gives major improvements to health care benefits for workers and their families. Workers will now be eligible for these benefits if they work 20 hours a week. Previously, eligibility required a minimum of 30 hours a week. The contract also establishes paid sick time and a 5% wage increase. The vote comes after several near strikes in Nanaimo and Victoria.
In Halifax, students from Dalhousie University, the University of King's College, and the Nova Scotia School of Art and Design took part in the Night of Living Debt Walk, a zombie-themed demonstration against tuition fee increases and increasing debt. At the start of 2012, the government of Nova Scotia announced that tuition would be increased by 3% and government grants to universities would be reduced. Throughout the Quebec student strike, a frequent argument lobbied against demonstrators fighting the hike in Quebec was that students attending school in Nova Scotia accepted tuition hikes in their province.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
That was Demons by Noise Hounds from their album On Dope. Now it's time for Feature Stories.
Now we turn to a recorded interview with Torrance Cost, a Vancouver Island campaigner from the Wilderness Committee. Vanessa spoke to him regarding the October 31st Cohen Commission of Inquiry into the decline of sockeye salmon in the Fraser River.
It was mandated because of the ongoing decline over the last few decades of the Fraser River sockeye salmon run. This is one of the single biggest run in British Columbia for this species, and it's been a linchpin of the history and contemporary growth culturally and economically, especially before European colonization. They're one of, if not the most important species to the development and the prosperity of the rich indigenous cultures. And the ecological importance of these species is just second to none. The role they play can't be replaced. They're a species we absolutely can't afford to lose. The run has been in decline, and in 2009 it essentially crashed. A return of close to 10 million was expected back, and instead less than a million ended up returning. That prompted the federal government to commission this inquiry, and it was a two-year study basically into the causes of that. And a root cause that I do a lot of work on here in Victoria is the impact of open net salmon farms. This is basically a runaway industry that's really grown over the last two decades, which is exactly the time frame that the wild stocks have declined, and we hope the federal government's going to do something about the recommendations. What's alarming is that dating back, key example is the budget bill, C-38, that was passed in the House of Commons in June of this year, which essentially gutted the budget for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, laid off a third of the habitat protection staff for wild salmon. How can we be finding out as much as we can about these fish, about how to protect them, about how to ensure that we have healthy runs into the future when we're cutting funding? It's not what Cohen recommends, and it's not what we recommend.
Now we'll listen to audio recorded at November 14th action that took place outside of British Columbia MP Christy Clark's office in support of the Cohen inquiry into the decline of the sockeye salmon population.
Okay, like she says, my name is Melina Dawson. And I can only speak for myself and my family, but I know that we don't think that salmon... I know that we know that salmon farms aren't doing anything for us or any of our small communities for that matter. So I'm gonna hand the mic over to Alex, and she can tell you more about the technical, scientific stuff. And she's pretty much been adopted to our people and family and that, so here she is.
Thank you, Melina. Melina's come from a very, very remote village. They had to raise money to fly her out by seaplane, so it's a long way that she's come. And it happens that I've lived in her territory for 26 years, and the salmon farming industry is extremely dangerous to the wild fish. I'm tracking three European viruses right now the government forgot to tell Justice Cohen about. When he released the disease records, he actually saw symptoms of them in the farm salmon, and that's why I went searching for these viruses, and they're there. So we're going to ring the doorbell and deliver 11,712 signatures to Premier Christy Clark, asking her not to renew the salmon farm leases, particularly in Molina's territory. They're being faced with 18 salmon farm renewals right now. The government is pressuring them and says they don't have a right to have an opinion to this because they can't show traditional use of the sea floor under the farms. So here we go.
Hey there, mister. What's your name? How this all happened and who's to blame? Come on!
In Toronto, the Downtown East campaign has been organizing around a set of community consultations run by the City of Toronto through the municipal government's new Community Homelessness Prevention Initiative. According to the campaign, this initiative is the result of funding cuts that have already been made and are yet to be made in Toronto. One men's shelter, called the Schoolhouse Shelter, was threatened to be shut down. The shelter is a wet shelter, which means that drinking alcohol is allowed on site. On November 14th, the city put forward recommendations to keep the shelter open, at least for the time being. However, they recommended making the shelter a dry shelter starting in the new year. The Downtown East campaign mobilized to be present outside this meeting. This next feature comes from audio recorded by a volunteer with the campaign, Mark.
Because we know that that kind of shelter, where men are allowed to drink inside, actually saves lives. In the winter of 1996, we had three men freeze to death on these streets. And there was an inquest in the summer. And the jury there decided that it was beneficial for the city to have a wet hostel. And that was one of the recommendations. Also, the last time we were at City Hall, every single presenter said that it was necessary to have that kind of shelter. So why are they not able to do this?
Got it.
So we want to go there and support the fact that they're going to keep this open, but we want to send a strong message that we need this shelter to be a wet shelter, and we'll continue to fight for that. So we're going to march over there, and let's go to City Hall.
Stop the war on the poor!
Make the rich pay.
Homeless people will no longer have the same rights in the schoolhouse shelter that stockbrokers, doctors, lawyers have, which is to go home to the place where they live and drink.
Shame!
Let me say that just as there are stockbrokers who have a drinking problem, there are some homeless people who have a drinking problem. The difference is that homeless people who drink have nowhere to go. And if you force people onto the streets, you put their lives in danger. What we are therefore voting for is social backwardness and ugliness, and we condemn it. We will continue the fight to keep the schoolhouse shelter open as a wet shelter and to expand those services. I also want to say that what is happening here around the schoolhouse and this fight has been that it is part of a bigger fight. It is a fight against gentrification. It is a fight against the development of this redevelopment of this neighbourhood that we live in and work in. It is a fight to push the poor out and turn the downtown east into a yuppie dormitory community. And we're not prepared to accept that. We're going to challenge it. We're going to continue to mobilise. So, our mobilisation so far has won us an important partial victory, but it's only a skirmish in a bigger fight. We've got to continue that fight. We've got to build and we've got to win. Thank you.
Now we head into the streets and back alleys of Montreal to listen to a feature on one of Montreal's biggest and sanctioned bike races, the Course des Morts. This year, the winner of the race was a woman, a first for this annual Montreal event and a big moment for some cyclists.
Alley cats are more, underground is the word for them. It's something that's planned by people who don't have a lot of, first of all, of money, of capital. It's something that's not sanctioned by the city or any official body. It's not that they're illegal, it's that they're, first of all, unknown, and they're also, like I said, unsanctioned. The origin of alley cats literally refers to alleys. I believe they started in the United States. And what messengers would do is they would meet after work and they would literally race in alleyways. Usually drag races, and that's where the term alley cat comes from. So they've always been amateur races started by people with not a lot of capital and not a lot of connections. So they're not illegal, technically, but they're, let's say, frowned upon by the police.
I have witnessed many alley cat races. I've raced many alley cat races, or just races in general, and women are not in the top, like in terms of like contending against men. And so tonight was really like a historical event in terms of like Montreal racing and like racing in general, where like the top, you know, like 10 were like dominated by women. If a woman wins, it's like super surprising. It's like, whoa, like why did you win? It's important to critique like the reaction that people have when like a woman wins. People are like, how can this be? You know, how is this possible? It basically validates the fact that, like, it's the assumption that a man is going to win. it shouldn't be a surprising thing, especially if the organizers proactively create races that are more tactical, that are more appealing to like a wide demographic of human beings, not just men and women, but just like human beings, then it equalizes the playing field. And I think that's what happened tonight. And the people who placed in the top were messengers. So it's like this tonight proved that like you needed to have tactic and skill and like a lot of endurance.
If it helps having been a bike messenger, yes, of course, because it's not just about the speed, but it's about your strategy and which road you're going to take. So yes, of course, it helps a lot.
How did you feel throughout the race?
I thought I was going to do really
badly.
Mikey,
let's go!
I kept watching people race by. I'm like, oh, I feel so slow already. Whatever. It's hard when you're in it. I never think I'm doing well.
Yeah, like, I'm honestly pretty surprised because I know the boys can beat me in a sprint, and I know that like if it was an A to B starting line, finish line, like all these boys would beat me. So I'm really excited that my route, like that I figured it out.
It gives confidence in ourselves too, because physically we all know usually men are stronger than women, but if we like arriving in the first 10, it shows that we are also able to do it, and we are able to think the best route too sometimes. Because like I say, it's not just about speed, but how being fluid in the traffic and managing all the checkpoint.
And to see so many women come out, so many women kick ass, is just like so exciting. I don't know. When I first started doing this, there were very few women racing. So, and that wasn't that long ago.
We now go to a feature based on articles written for a student newspaper, the McGill Daily. Christiana Collinson and Guillermo Martinez de Velasco are both McGill students who recently wrote about racism in the paper. Their articles have garnered national and international attention on platforms such as the Ottawa Citizen, the Vancouver Sun, and white supremacist websites. Now the discussion is coming to community radio airwaves.
So I wrote it because I read this article, and then it kind of made me realize how much what people understand to be racism isn't actually. So I was like, okay, I could write like a little piece about like racism, like kind of very basic stuff, 800 words.
Yeah, I think a lot of what my article was, and a lot of the reason why I wrote my article in response to yours was because I felt like it was such a great article. And I think that individuals were not understanding of like its necessity in especially the university context in terms of racisms, whether it be subtle or overt or whatever that we experience day to day. And because I basically went through your comments and like ton of the comments, you have no statistical evidence of everything you're proving. Yeah, let me just, you know, hit up Stats Canada and ask them to record every single racist thing that happens to racialized bodies, especially with something that is such a lived experience that I think a lot of people had difficulty with because you could not understand it because you haven't felt it.
And yeah, I mean, how do you even, like, how do you quantify that?
Well, I, after writing my article, I was featured on a white supremacist site. My email and my picture was featured on that site. And I distinctly remember like coming home from a really great show that happened in Montreal, and like going to my email and I'm like, oh, I was featured on this site. And I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Cause I didn't know what site it was. I go on the site and I'm like, oh my God, this is so scary. But it was scary because like in my mind, I just can't conceptualize how a white supremacist group would get their hands on a Canadian university specific newspaper's article, them having access to my face, and like I have nothing to hide. I'm not scared of anything. I just don't, like, it was just really upsetting that they had a lot of access to me and I had nothing in terms of them. It was really telling of the McGill community, like I like belong to, and like who exists in this space, and like how are these people not held accountable for things like this?
Like we were both featured, yes, kind of like exactly. At the same time on that site, and I thought it was like really scary. Maybe I'm just more paranoid.
No, I had that paranoid face.
And like too. I like tried to like look up, you know, this guy. You can't like you're gonna you can't just say those
exactly,
things, right?
Exactly.
It's freaking. It's not fun to no, like know that fun. There's like people that like hate you to that point somewhere.
I want to hear about this Ottawa citizen.
How did I find out about it? I think someone posted it on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And was like, you're famous. And I was like, wow, they're writing about my article. Wow. And yeah, so in the article, he kind of just like uses my article mm-hmm. as an example of how universities in North America are just becoming these awful like ideology machines. And the fact that like it was republished, how did that happen?
Like, I can't understand how that article was published and like no one was freaking out.
I could talk about this. For a long time.
Oh, I've been talking about it for a long time.
Yeah. But I mean, it'd be interesting to hear from
our listeners. Yeah, we have listeners.
And see what questions they have, what kind of stuff we could discuss next time.
Because I think that we're really open to listening to comments. Like, we genuinely love hearing feedback. And yep. I think it would be like really awesome if you guys could send us your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Questions, comments, responses.
Yep. Send them in.
Christiana and Guillermo will be back on Groundwire in 2 weeks' time to continue the discussion, hopefully with your feedback and questions to respond to. We hope that you read their articles posted on Groundwire Radio News' Facebook account, as well as our Twitter account at Groundwire News. You can email questions, comments, or responses to Christiana and Guillermo at groundwireprod, P-R-O-D, @gmail.com. Now that you're gone and you're out on your own, you can find some other brain to call your home. I'm trying to find the answers, but I'm too far from home. And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. Last episode, we aired a clip from the Cheam Nation's fundraising call. This week, we follow up on the story in an interview with Jessica Benson, who is working closely with the community to get Pilalt on air.
So how is the fundraising efforts going?
So far, in total, we've fundraised about $1,900 Canadian. We're still rounding up the equipment, and it's literally like as soon as it comes in, then we'll be good to go. We could probably be on the air a lot sooner if we applied for different grants, but I think a lot of people are really wanting to go their own way with the radio station and try to fundraise as much money on our own, because I guess we don't want to be, we want to follow our own guidelines, I guess. So I guess that's why we're kind of going the fundraising route, which is a little bit harder, but I think it's worthwhile in the end.
One thing on the website, it talked about the radio station being a way to preserve Cheam Nation's language. I guess could you talk a little bit about that, kind of how the idea of using radio came up?
That was actually a big part of Fyan for the Radio, was to have a very strong Halkamalam language component. And Halkamalam is the language that is spoken here traditionally. I guess the reality is there are not very many fluent speakers left. In Cheam, we have one speaker, and her name is Elizabeth Phillips. There's a real urgency to revitalize that language. I was actually talking to a fluent speaker last night, and she was saying one of the biggest threats to our Indigenous languages is actually the English language, because it's everywhere. Like, even when you're trying to learn, it's everywhere that you go. And even just to be able to tune in to your own radio station in your own community here in Cheam, and to have that language be to actually hear it on your own radio station, is actually a big step in the right way. And even just identifying as Pilalt, which is the tribe that they are here in Cheam, just to be able to claim those airwaves and to proudly identify as we are Pilalt is huge. And once we had the radio station with that, I noticed a lot of people were really proud of Pilalt FM. There's actually, once we started the radio station, there's been a lot of people in the community I've discovered that have so much talent and so many things to say and so many voices and songs and stories and different ways that people can contribute. And I guess like a lot of times when I hear people talking about grassroots radio, sometimes I hear the saying that giving a voice to the voiceless, which I would disagree with and I kind of don't like, because it's clear in Chiam, for example, that we do have voices, very strong ones, very powerful, with lots of things to say. Maybe we just don't have an audience or a platform to get that. So I would just encourage other people to just give it a try and go for it, or get in touch with me as well. I'd be happy to offer support or words of wisdom or whatever.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire from CKUT in Montreal. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Erin.
And I'm Vanessa. Music this week was by Noise Hounds from Sackville, New Brunswick.
Headlines this week were written by Erin Hudson.
We would also like to thank Alex for filming at the Wild Salmon Protest, Mark with Downtown East Campaign, Catherine Fisher, and Frida Warren.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download the episode at groundwire.ncra.ca.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.